You are tuned to KBOO 90.7 FM in Portland. Coming up next, Bread and Roses. This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from, in other words, Women's Books and Resources, your local nonprofit feminist bookstore and resource center offering community space, events, gifts, tools for the revolution, a comprehensive collection of women's writings, and more, located at 3734 Southeast Hawthorne and on the web at inotherwords.org.
On Friday, February 3rd at 6 p.m., tune in for Bread and Roses. Host Denise Kowalczyk will talk to Planned Parenthood for an update on pro-choice issues, to local nonprofit bookstore, in other words, about some great books on motherhood and feminism, and to a board member from Insight's Teen Parent Program who will talk about teen motherhood. That's on Friday, February 3rd from 6 p.m. to 7 p.m. right here on your community radio station, KBOO. Welcome to Bread and Roses, Feminist News and Public Affairs on KBOO 90.7 FM in Portland. I'm Leanne Kranz.
And I'm Brooke Kavanaugh. On tonight's program, we'll be featuring an interview with Suzanne Marie Fenger, who will be talking about social aggression among preschool-age girls. And we'll have her on the phone in about 5 minutes. And I'd like to take this opportunity to welcome our newest collective member here at Bread and Roses, Leanne Kranz, thank you so much for being part of our collective.
Thank you. It's a great group.
And so we'll be hearing that interview with Suzanne Marie Fenger and Leanne Kranz coming up in just a few minutes. But we're going to start off the show with a piece from a continuing series that I've been airing on Bread and Roses programs. And it's a collection of women talking about what it means to be a woman. The goal of this project is to continue expanding what we mean when we say the word woman, and to recognize our similarities, our differences, and what makes our particular experiences unique. And this evening's segment is of a woman named Hava. So let's go ahead and hear from Hava.
My name is Hava. I am 31. I'm from Littleton, Colorado, and I am a teacher and a researcher. To be a woman is a lot of different things, and I think these are all things I've realized in my adult life. But for a long time, I didn't want to be a woman. I didn't want to identify as a woman. And I think I've always associated it with powerlessness and weakness. And so, but now I see it's kind of coming from a place of weakness and powerlessness into a great potential of power and resistance. So being a woman means to discover strength after going through a period of not knowing you have strength, And I think that's something many women don't take for granted, to discover their strength. And it's also to be socialized to be quiet and pleasing and accommodating, and to experience the joy and power of straying from those prescriptions. And I felt that for the first time as a teenager, actually, when I protested the KKK in Denver, and then again as a young woman when I protested the WTO in Seattle. And I've also felt that joy and terror as a teacher of women's and gender studies, when I've offended my students and took the risk of not being liked in order to make a stand and in order to bring up uncomfortable topics of discussion. And also being a woman means learning about one's voice and not taking it for granted, and discovering it and learning it rather than just having it and using it. So I think there's a certain joy and a danger and awareness in using one's voice as a woman. And that's something many men, or certain men, might not experience as much or in the same ways. And it also means being on the edge of two worlds. So like many marginalized people who have to live in a dominant world and their own world, I think being a woman means to have a double consciousness. And so oftentimes it means to be split in two. And that can be fun and transgressive, and it can also be confusing and distressing. And it's also, to be a woman is also to build a life on the basis of social inequality, and at the same time, it's to have a basis of solidarity and empowerment. And sometimes it's hard to find that basis, but it's a joy when we can find it. And so I'm encouraged by all the women's movements that have emerged recently, Code Pink, women's Muslim movements, women's environmental movements here and in India and all over the world, and global justice movements. And finally, to be a woman is to be a keeper of social networks. And so it's to understand one's life fundamentally in terms of our relationship to others. And ironically, this can lead women to become isolated from certain spheres of life where men are usually dominant. I think about movies like A Beautiful Mind or movies that celebrate great men geniuses, and there's always a woman there who's kind of keeping his life from falling apart, his house clean and keeping his social networks from falling apart. And I often wonder why no one makes a movie about that woman. So even though it's not a celebrated thing to be the keeper of social networks, it's a really valuable thing, and it can be a basis for a great movement, I think. So that has a lot of potential. And mostly being a woman is learning that many things in our lives that we thought of as personal, individual, private problems are really connected to social issues. And so, again, that's that move from being powerless to powerful.
And that was Hava talking about what it means to her to be a woman. If you are interested in either being interviewed or conducting an interview for this series about what it means to be a woman, please send me your contact information. You can send it here to KBOO and put attention, Bread and Roses, and put my name down, which is Brooke. Or you can send an email to pmnews@kboo.org and put Bread and Roses in the subject heading. Well, coming up, stay tuned for an interview with Suzanne Marie Fenger about social aggression in preschool-age girls, and we'll be right back.
Welcome back to Bread and Roses. I'm Leanne Kranz. Our guest tonight is Suzanne Marie Fenger, a former early childhood educator now involved in the study of social aggression among preschool age girls. She's joining us on the phone tonight from Austin, Texas. Welcome, Suzanne.
Thank you, Leanne.
Okay, Suzanne, why don't you just bring us all in the loop on how you got involved in this study?
Sure, Leanne. Well, a number of years ago, I was teaching preschool at a school, Peter's Place Nursery School in San Francisco, where I resided until recently, and was watching a few of our five-year-old girls playing, Greta and Meg, and they were playing a pretend game about cats, and it was very sweet and charming. They were licking the milk up and mewing at each other, and it was just very sweet. And a third girl, Sarah, came over and asked if she could play. And Greta looked up at her, smiling very sweetly, and said, "Well, you could play, but we're pretending we're cats, but we're orphan cats, and, well, we're orphans, and that means our mommy's dead, and we're sisters, and they're only sisters in this game, and so since our mommy's dead, she can't have any more babies, and so we can't have any more sisters."
Okay.
And I, you know, aside from trying very hard not to laugh, started trying to figure out what was going on that had made Greta say to a direct request to play something so amazingly complicated and convoluted.
Very sophisticated, too.
It was extremely sophisticated for a five-year-old.
Mm-hmm.
And started doing a little research and started learning about social and relational aggression.
Would you mind defining those terms for us?
Sure. I'm going to start by just talking about aggression in general, because I know that back in the olden days when I was in college, when the professor spoke about aggression, the only type of aggression they were really referring to was physical aggression, what's now termed overt aggression. That's the kind of aggression that, you know, is kicking, hitting, punching, most commonly associated with boys. I was taught in my, you know, psychology program that after all the research they had done and all the science, that the only real difference they had discovered between boys and girls was that boys were more aggressive than girls.
Mm-hmm.
But really they were just referring to overt aggression. So that's just, now we've noticed that there are lots of other types of aggression, and that's just one of the types. Verbal aggression, rather obvious, is another type.
Mm-hmm.
And just recently, people started studying what are termed together the alternative aggressions, and that can be social aggression, relational aggression, covert aggression, indirect aggression. And because this field is so new and people have only been researching it for the last 15 years, the terms are actually still being debated, and everybody kind of has their own terms to use, their own ways to look at it, unfortunately.
Mm-hmm.
When I look at the behavior of preschool girls, I use two terms myself, social aggression and relational aggression. So to me, social aggression is aggression that damages another person's social status, most commonly rumors and gossip.
Oh, yeah.
In preschoolers, her shoes are for babies, or she doesn't know how to play Candyland the right way.
Mm-hmm.
Damaging social status.
Very damaging for that age bracket.
It is. Baby shoes are a serious business.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas relational aggression, in my own definition, is aggression more within the context of a friendship, bossing a friend or excluding a friend from a game. If you don't be the witch, you can't come to my birthday party. And this one was featured in a study that Amy Sheldon did. You can be the baby brother, but you're not born yet.
My gosh.
So that type of aggression, the social and relational aggression, now people have started talking about it in the context of that being a more feminine style of aggression. And although boys do engage in it, I think that a lot of people in our culture right now are struggling with social and relational aggression as a female phenomenon.
And, you know, looking back, you know, I remember certain kids that got labeled as babies in kindergarten, and that reputation followed them to high school, you know. I mean, this is pretty interesting, serious stuff.
Yes.
So, okay, this is a newly emerging study. Even the terms are being defined at this point.
Mm-hmm.
So when you went back to your fellow preschool teachers with this information, kind of cutting-edge information, how was it received?
Well, I think most of the teachers I've spoken with have been really interested in it. I think a lot of them struggle with, even in the preschool years, exclusion amongst their girls and trying to understand why it happens and then what to do about it. Mm-hmm. I think the first time I gave a talk, I had almost 400 people come, which shocked me. Mm-hmm. And they all had stories about one of those girls in their classrooms. But it's a little bit tricky because at the same time, when you think about exclusion and, you know, Greta's example of, you know, not letting someone into a game about orphan cats, it seems pretty minor when you're thinking about the other stuff that happens in preschool. You know, you're worried about physical safety, people falling mm-hmm. off of high things or getting hit.
Mm-hmm.
So in preschool, it's, you know, it seems to, you know, go a little lower priority. But when you look at older girls, relational aggression is so significant for them and so painful. There was a study done that asked boys and girls their opinions on the severity of relational aggression versus physical aggression versus verbal aggression, trying to get a measure of what children thought of it, if one was more painful or worse than another. And girls across the ages rated relational aggression as painful as physical aggression.
As painful.
Yes, and 12-year-old girls, we all know about 12-year-old girls, rated relational aggression more painful than physical aggression. That means that they would rather have someone hit them than spread a rumor about them.
Mm-hmm. So currently we're not treating these sorts of alternative aggressions as we're treating the physical aggressions. There's not the same focus or emphasis in the classroom. And teachers aren't being prepared to deal with these issues, it sounds like.
Exactly. I think mm-hmm. that there's a lot of focus in the preschool years in helping children to combat and get mm-hmm. under control physical aggression.
Bullies, you know,
Yeah, and we all worry so much about our children being victimized physically, but I think that there is a much smaller emphasis, almost no emphasis, on the relational aggression side of things.
Hmm. So I'm curious, have you ever had to approach some parents about the behavior of their child, their daughter?
You know, I feel like I've interacted with parents around the subject sort of in a different way. I did a number of years ago speak with a parent at our preschool, and she asked the director and myself to come in and meet with her for a special conference because she was concerned about her older daughter. Her daughter was at the time in first grade mm-hmm. and had gone to the preschool previously.
Mm-hmm.
And the mother wanted to get some feedback from the educators, us, because her daughter was currently in the middle of a friendship that she was uncomfortable with. And she wasn't really sure if she should do anything about it and what she should do. So she asked for a conference and came in. And when she started telling the story, besides my jaw trying not to drop open, I sort of started thinking really deeply about what was going on. She started talking about her daughter, Meg, who had three good friends. One of them was the leader of the group. And that girl was so in control of the other girls in the group that they needed to ask her permission to go to the bathroom. And the leader, had tacit permission to hit the girls if they did anything wrong. And when I looked shocked and horrified, the mother reassured me, "Oh, I don't think she's ever really done it. Meg says she hasn't really hit them."
It's just in the rules.
yes, but it's in the rules. Mm-hmm. And at that point, the mother started apologizing and saying that she knew it wasn't a big deal and that she was probably just worried about nothing, and her husband had told her it was Meg's problem and we shouldn't concern ourselves about it, and that's just a girl thing. And I spent the rest of the hour trying to convince her what a terrible situation Meg was going through and how awful it was and how important it was to help her handle it, because a six-year-old doesn't know how to handle something that significant.
Right. You know, whereas, you know, if they were you're having a conference about this child being physically aggressive, you know, the parents would, of course, intervene. It'd be a top priority.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's just...
Yeah. And this mother was just worried about if her husband would approve, and she didn't want to take any steps that might affect their schedule or make them change their plans at all.
Hmm. You know, you said the term girl stuff. That reminds me of, you know, boys will be boys. Like, we kind of ignore certain behaviors as because, you know, we assume they're just normal, typical things. We don't necessarily dig deeper into how damaging those acceptable, quote-unquote, behaviors can be.
Yeah, I think that the relational and social aggression are held to very different standards than physical aggression because they're seen as less damaging.
Mm-hmm. Well, the bruises are hidden, you know.
Yes, exactly. They are. But there's, you know, I think that there are a lot of instances of differences in the treatment of males and females. And although physical aggression and relational aggression are not the same, girls feel like they're the same as...
Or worse.
Yes, or worse, exactly. Mm-hmm. But our culture tends to see male and female behavior, you know, quite differently in many different ways. So it's kind of hard to figure out exactly... You know, exactly what's going on.
Can you talk a little bit about that? How the culture sees the genders differently?
Well, sure.
Good.
Well, I think that I'm going to reference a number of studies that I've been reading papers about. One really interesting but very simple study asked boys, in the study, boys and girls were asked to say the exact same thing. And they were coached on inflection and tone so that they sounded exactly alike. And then other adults watched the children saying these words. And they were, you know, forceful words. And the adults then commented on what they had seen. Mm-hmm. When the boys were saying the forceful words, the comments were using language like assertive. And when the girls were speaking, the comments involved things such as bossy and confrontational.
You know, this reminds me, when I was in kindergarten, my kindergarten teacher called my mom and said, "You need to take Leanne to a psychiatrist. She's too competitive." And my mom was, you know, like, she was a little bit surprised, and she said, "Well, can you explain, you know, why you think this?" And she said, "Well, you know, teacher said, on days that we have gym class, Leanne just jumps up and has to be the first person at the door every time." And my mom said, "Well, she loves gym." And that's true. I was obsessed with kickball. But, you know, I was too competitive. That was a negative. But, you know, imagine one of my male classmates leaping up to the door. It would have been, like, normal. Like, ah, red-blooded boy. Yeah.
Oh, wow. That's very sad. There was another study where they, and you got to love the researchers who came up with this stuff, they had children go outside in snowsuits, so bundled up in snow gear that you couldn't tell if they were boys or girls. And then they just videotaped them playing in the snow. And once again, then they had adults witness this behavior. And when the adults watched videotapes, the researchers would say, "Oh, that's two boys playing. What do you think about it?" Or, "That's two girls playing. What do you think about it?"
Mm-hmm.
When they saw two boys playing, they said, "Oh, that's, you know, they're playing. It's playful. It's normal." When they were told that the exact same thing, some people were told they were boys and some people were told they were girls, when they were told that the people who were told they were girls said that it was aggressive play. And it was not playful, but it was aggressive. But it was the exact same situation. But when they thought it was girls, it's aggressive, it's scary.
Inappropriate, right.
Mm-hmm.
Inappropriate for girls.
Yeah, yeah. I think our culture sees expression of aggression by girls in a very different way than it sees the exact same behavior, expression of aggression by boys.
Surprise, surprise.
Yeah.
I just want to remind our listeners that you're listening to Bread and Roses, and our guest tonight is Suzanne Marie Fanger, a former early childhood educator now studying social aggression among preschool age girls. So,
you know, Leanne, while you were saying that, it made me think of another study, which related more to adult behavior, but to me really kind of shows how significant the cultural differences between expression of aggression in males and females are. Time magazine did an article on spousal murder, and they had looked at what prison terms people were given for murdering their spouses.
Mm-hmm.
Men, on average, were given 2 to 6 years for killing their wives. Women were given 15 to 20 years for killing their husbands.
Well, so clearly we have gender-specific value judgments on behaviors. We're holding girls and boys to very different standards. So can you speak to us, since you've delved into the science, can you talk to us about, you know, are there any inherent differences between men and women that would explain the different ways our culture and individuals treat the individual genders?
Sure. I think that there are actually quite a few biological differences between males and females that may or may not reflect how we see aggression and all this behavior of males and females differently. I think one really piece that I find endlessly fascinating is the majority of women's brains, or females' brains, are structured differently from male brains. And one of the ways in which they're structured differently is that the amygdala, which is the emotional center of the brain, is involved in almost all brain processes that females do. Whereas for men, it's not involved. Usually males have a very area-specific brain functioning style. Women, whenever they're thinking about anything, the thoughts go through their amygdala at some point. They go through the center of our emotion, of our gut reactions, of our intuition, and that's always a part of the brain's process. So I just think that's fascinating.
And that's not the case for men?
No. In men, their brains tend to be more focused on just, you know, if they're working on a math problem, the math area of the brain, to put it really simply, will be involved. Whereas if a female is working on a math problem, the math area of the brain and the amygdala will be involved. So brain differences are sort of one area in which males and females are different. Another area is behaviorally, there have been some, here's another one where the scientists came up with some good ones, studying infants. Because infants are not yet influenced by culture and by their parenting and their upbringing, infanthood is the only time when you can really truly look at the nature, the biology mm-hmm. of a person to see if there are differences.
Mm-hmm.
So they have, various scientists have discovered that female infants prefer to look at faces, whereas male infants prefer to look at mechanical objects. They've discovered that infant girls initiate more social interaction than infant boys, that female infants are more responsive than male infants to the distress cries of other babies.
Mm-hmm.
And I just think all of that is just, it's amazing that they can figure that out about infants. And I think there's one more area that I wanted to briefly touch on as far as biological differences,
mm-hmm.
And that is reaction to stress. I, as an anthropology student, spent a lot of time learning about the fight or flight reaction,
mm-hmm.
that, you know, biological reaction to stress, where all of our hormones start going crazy and we get lots of adrenaline, and it's, you know, because, you know, all through evolution, this system has been built into our bodies so that we would either run away from the scary woolly mammoth or stay and fight it.
Mm-hmm.
But just recently, there has been some research done that has shown that under stress, women have a very different response. It turns out that the fight-or-flight research was done on men. No one actually checked that out on women.
Unbelievable.
Yeah, and so when they looked at females under stress, although they did eventually, under extreme, extreme stress, get the adrenaline, just like, you know, as we all know, and which would symbolize the kick-in of the fight-or-flight reaction, mm-hmm. their first reaction to stress was to produce a very different hormone, oxytocin. That's a hormone that's linked to calming feelings, reduction of fear. It is the same hormone that is produced during childbirth. and it's also linked to social memory.
Mm-hmm.
So it seems as if biologically the female first response to stress is to form alliances, to care for your young, that this new idea is being termed tend and befriend as opposed to fight or flight.
Interesting. So aggression would be more of a secondary response naturally for women. Our first response would be tend or befriend.
That's what the research is indicating at this point.
Ooh, okay, well, let's take a little break. That's a lot to think about. I'm going to play a song now by Aretha Franklin. So the next time anyone tries to pull any of this stuff on you, just remember what she says. Welcome back to Bread and Roses. That was Aretha Franklin with Think. Very good advice. Our guest tonight is Suzanne Marie Fanger, a former early childhood educator, now studying social aggression among preschool age girls. To briefly summarize, Suzanne just led us through some of the biological differences between men and women. And we found out that women process through their emotional center of their brain, where, shockingly, men can turn it off. and also that in response to stress, fight or flight was taken as kind of de facto human information, that we all reacted to stress in this way. But in fact, women produce different hormones under stress. They, instead of fighting or flighting, they tend and befriend. Their hormones encourage them to care for each other and to bond. So, Suzanne, how do these biological differences play out in terms of aggression?
Well, earlier I mentioned that I had been taught that men were more aggressive, meaning more overtly aggressive, mm-hmm. than females. But, in fact, it's so much more complicated than that. Aggression, it's very difficult to look at from a gendered perspective. In order to survive as a species, humans need to have an aggressive reaction. There are times when survival depends on the ability to run or fight, whether it's your own life or the life of a child. So, in my opinion, aggression is an inherent part of our biology. It's what we do with that biology that's affected by our culture and by our gender.
Hmm.
So, going back to that old viewpoint that men are more aggressive, I looked at that a lot and found some research that indicated that in certain circumstances, women can be equally aggressive, and that, in fact, culture is more predictive of levels of aggression than gender is. For example, there's a little place off the coast of Venezuela, Margarita Island, mm-hmm. where women are considered to be more aggressive than men. And, you know, if you were to go to Margarita Island and interview anybody there about the differences between males and females, they would say females are more aggressive, males are passive. Another interesting piece of science coming from the U.S. gave adults opportunities at aggression where there was no possibility of detection, where no one could ever know if you were going to do something mean. So would you do it if no one would ever know that you were going to do this thing? And equal. Men and women had equal instances of aggression when there was no possibility of detection. So although there are biological differences, it doesn't seem to be directly related to the prevalence of aggression.
So why is aggression manifesting so differently in men and women? Why do we have the overt physical aggression from men and the more relational, social from women?
Yeah, well, I think that in our culture, in the U.S. and in a number of other Western cultures, we begin at birth to teach our girls what they're supposed to be like. We teach mm-hmm. them a number of things. And one of the things, as I learned in college, going back to it again, one of the things we're taught is that males are naturally aggressive, they have testosterone, and if females are aggressive, it's abnormal. So girls start hearing from birth, and boys start hearing from birth, these ideas. We're not aggressive, we're women. So girls are taught that aggression is bad. They're taught that conflict is bad. And I don't know about you, but there's a lot of adults out there who their mantra with young children is be nice.
Yes.
Share. And we're always trying to smooth things out and avoid conflict, particularly for our girls.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they're the designated angels of our society.
Mm-hmm.
Sugar and spice and everything nice.
Yes, and it really gives them no opportunity to express aggression, to have angry feelings, to deal with conflicts that might come up in friendships. I think that we are teaching our girls not only that you got to be nice about everything, but we're teaching them to subvert their own needs for the needs of others,
mm-hmm.
that you would never say no to somebody or hurt somebody's feelings. There was, going back to another lovely study done, they had a large group of toddlers playing. And with their parents, with their mothers watching, most of these studies, unfortunately, are done with mothers.
Mm-hmm.
So little research on fatherhood, unfortunately, at this point. The mothers were watching, and as happens with toddlers all the time, the children took toys out of each other's hands.
Mm-hmm.
Perfectly natural. What was interesting about this study was that if a son had a toy taken out of his hand, that mm-hmm. son's mother was three times more likely to help the boy get the toy back than if it was a daughter. So if a mother had a boy, she would make sure, you know, in most circumstances, that if another child took a toy out of his hand, he got it back. If a mother had a girl, she usually tried to help her see the other child's perspective and pacify her by giving her a different toy to play with.
So women are complicit in this. We are perpetuating these differences.
Yeah. Yes, unfortunately. I think that we're so unaware of what is going on and how subtle all of it's happening that we're enculturating our children even though we don't mean to and even though it would never occur to us that we were doing such a thing.
Mm-hmm.
And our girls learn it oh so early. There was another, Charisse Nixon did her dissertation, and one of the amazing things that came up when she was doing this work was looking at boys' and girls' responses to disappointment. So I've got to give you the background on the study here.
Okay.
The children were asked to play a game. The game itself was completely irrelevant to the actual study, and they were told, after you finish the game, you're going to get a prize. And then the researchers showed the children all the prizes that they might get. And then they asked them, which prize do you like best? Which prize do you like second best? You know, which mm-hmm. prize don't you like at all?
Mm-hmm.
And the children rated their prizes. And the prizes ranged from a brand new box of crayons and, you know, a really cool squishy ball. So, mm-hmm. like, actually things that children would like to get, mm-hmm. to pencil shavings and a broken pencil. And then they had them play the game. And the first time they played the game, they gave them their first choice of the prize. They gave them the brand new crayons. Mm-hmm. And, of course, the children were all excited. The second time they played the game, they gave them the worst prize possible. So they gave them a pile of pencil shavings or mm-hmm. a broken pencil.
Mm-hmm.
And by and large, when the girls, when the boys were given these prizes, the bad ones, the pencil shavings, they would throw the broken pencil across the room or say, I don't want that. That's not what I wanted. And when the girls were given the broken pencil or the shavings, the girls would try to mask their disappointment. And this is 4 and 5 year old girls. And they would look at the researcher and thank them very nicely.
Oh, my.
And one girl even tried to write with her broken pencil and pretended that it worked.
You know, so many things come to mind hearing that. I mean, in one sense, you know, the boys are speaking their minds. You know, they feel fully confident to say how they truly feel about what they got. But, you know, on the flip side, maybe they have this massive sense of entitlement. How dare you? And then, but on the, you know, on the other end of that spectrum, girls are, you know, obviously bending over backwards to put other people's feelings before their own. I mean, it's like, it's sad, but in a way, you know, it's nice to teach people to be polite. And when you get a gift, you don't insult the person who gave it to you. It's just that these things are just, they just seem so out of balance. You know, like neither is necessarily bad or wrong. It's just mm-hmm. way out of balance.
Well, you can see the good intention behind the cultural trend that has created children who are trying to please others.
Yeah.
You can see that in certain circumstances it could be appropriate or good. The problem comes when it is taught to the exclusion of all other
exactly.
options for behavior.
So, can we talk about, with the time we have remaining, can we talk about what we can do as parents or teachers to recalibrate our children from these imbalances? What kind of solutions do you have at this point?
Sure, I think there's a whole bunch of stuff that can be done. And, you know, first I'm going to talk about just general cultural pieces. I think that we're giving all of our children, but in particular our girls, some very confusing messages.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's so important to start letting our children know that being nice isn't always appropriate. Yes isn't always the right answer.
Mm-hmm.
As I say to my girls, my preschool girls, frequently, taking care of yourself is your first job.
Mm-hmm.
I was talking to a group of girls a couple years ago, and I had told them a story in which there was this one girl, and she was just a terrible playmate. Every chance she got, she would take the toy out of your hand. She would say you were bad and she didn't like you. She would do just about everything possible to be a bad person, you know, if you can call children that. And so I then set up a scenario for them. So then this child, this scary person, comes and asks you to play again. And you know that every time you play, it goes terribly and you're miserable. What do you say when she comes to ask you again?
Mm-hmm.
And universally, this group of 8 5-year-old girls said, yes. And so I started asking them, well, why would you say yes? That just makes no sense. I mean, you know, you guys, you know, and I talked to them about, what do you think it would be like to play with her again? Oh, she'd be mean to me. It'd be terrible. Finally, one of the most socially sophisticated girl in the bunch said, well, you could say, I'll play with you in a little bit.
So they're not comfortable just saying no.
Exactly.
Imagine the implications for adolescent girls, people.
Yes, exactly. I think it's You know, another piece of this being nice isn't always appropriate. Another thing is aggression can be okay. It's physical aggression in particular is something that for boys they have a much higher comfort level with. It carries less significance because it's something that they play about and try out in their rough and tumble play much more frequently than girls. And when you think about that, it has far-reaching implications for self-defense and self-preservation. And and if girls are terrified by any thought of physical aggression, it's going to really affect their comfort level with being confrontational or aggression of any sort. You know, I think it's so important to teach our children that conflict is important. And, you know, at Peter's Place, the school that I taught at, we spent a lot of time helping the children learn how okay conflict is and that you have to have a conflict in order to solve a problem. And you have to practice the conflict to get good at it. You know, conflict is a natural,
inevitable human
inevitable
condition.
Thing that happens, and conflict is how two people or a group of people reach a consensus. And if you don't have a conflict, you can't ever really reach a compromise or a consensus. And just like everything else that you learn as a child, it's a skill that needs to be practiced. And if you as a girl are spending all of your time avoiding conflict and being nice, you're never going to practice it. Just like the alphabet, you gotta write A's over and over again before you really know how to write an A. You have to solve conflicts over and over again before you really feel comfortable and okay solving conflicts.
Got it.
I think, should I just press on with some more solutions?
Yeah, we have about 2 minutes left, so whatever you can tell us in that time, we'd love to hear it.
Okay, well, I think another piece that is really important that is especially in our school of, in our country where we're really thinking about, you know, right now about the ABCs and making sure that everybody can read and write and you know, leaving no children behind, et cetera. Social and emotional education and values education get left in the dust. And they are so crucial. You know, as I was talking about with conflict resolution, children need to have formal instruction in social and emotional education. They need to be able to play about it and have games about it in order to develop friendship skills and be able to cooperate and work as a group. And they need, you know, help developing new values that are going to protect them from social and relational aggression.
Absolutely. You know, what strikes me in this conversation is that the way we're raising boys and girls, it's like neither are able to be fully human. You know, we all are born with this array of responses and emotions, but it seems like each gender is living in kind of biological shutdown. You know, women aren't able to express or feel comfortable with their opinion or their self-defense, quote, aggression. And, of course, boys are taught to avoid anything labeled feminine. So when we come to resolve conflicts on a global level, for instance, you know, there are just these massive imbalances. And, you know, women and men don't have an equal place at the table to come up with these solutions either. So it's really, this emotional education you're talking about, I just think is vital for the future of our species in the planet and every other nation.
Yes, I, you know, naturally I wouldn't be caring about this and studying relational aggression if I didn't agree. I think that, you know, if these children had these opportunities, they would learn such better styles of resolving problems than resorting to gossip and exclusion, than, you know, making another child's life miserable through bullying them in whatever shape and form. And I'm glad you brought up boys because, you know, naturally we haven't really been talking about them. But on the other side of the spectrum, I think that in our culture, boys are struggling just as much as girls and in very different ways, almost, you know, as you said, the other side of it. And I think that, you know, helping children with social and emotional skills and conflict skills would really change the playing field for all children, for boys and girls.
And, you know, these definitions, we have these very strict gender identifications for male and female, and they're just, I don't think they have a lot to do with the full human experience. So.
Yes. Oh, how true that is. So do we have time to talk about anything else, or are we all finished?
Brooke, how much time do we have left, my dear?
There's maybe 3 minutes.
3 minutes, actually. So well, if you want to talk about anything else that you're trying to... I know you're developing curricula right now to help share with other teachers. Thank you for that.
Uh-huh.
So anything you want to share with us about
well,
that?
I guess I'll just briefly, you know, I think that when I first started thinking about social and emotional education and conflict resolution,
mm-hmm.
it's a little hard to kind of wrap your mind around, particularly in the context of preschoolers. How do you teach children social skills? How do you teach children emotional skills or conflict resolution skills?
Mm-hmm.
And the, you know, and I think that still in the preschool world, we talk a lot about social and emotional education, but it's really tricky to do. And I think that the school that I was a part of was very unusual because we spent so much effort on it, and we actually did a lot of curriculum based on social emotional education. I would, for example, when we were a play-based school, so the children were just free to play all day and, mm-hmm. and move about the room, and I would set up an activity and give them a choice of one thing they could do would be to have a pretend conflict. And we would take, I would take a truck and set it up very carefully for them, explaining it. Okay, now two people get to pretend that they both want the truck at the same time. And then you guys get to try and practice solving it and see if you can figure it out. And it's amazing to see when you add pieces like that into the curriculum,
mm-hmm.
how competent the children become and how facile it is for them to solve a problem. It's really, it's quite an amazing transformation.
Interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Wow, that's encouraging.
I think so.
So, Suzanne, if anyone listening out there is interested in learning more about this study, where should they go? Are there resources you can recommend?
Yeah, I can certainly recommend a lot of things. I have a couple favorite books that I've recommended to many people over the years.
You can mention those really quickly. We'd appreciate
it. Sure.
Thank you.
There's a book called Girl Fighting by Lynn Michael Brown, and that is just it's one book. If you're going to read one book on social aggression, that's one to read. It's very fun.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, if you're interested in the secret lives of girls, there's one book called The Secret Lives of Girls, What Good Girls Really Do, Sex, Play, Aggression, and Their Guilt by Sharon Lamb. That is, it's very engaging and, you know, covers all sorts of fascinating topics like Barbie and Ken.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's another show.
Yes, yes, exactly.
Well, Suzanne, thank you very much for being our guest tonight. This is fascinating information. I'm still wrapping my mind around it. I think I have to grow another lobe. But
Thanks for having me, Leanne.
You're welcome. Thank you so much. And we'll be right back. Welcome back to Bread and Roses. Well, before we wrap up tonight, there's a few events that we would like to tell you about. Let's see if I can find them. Well, one event is Bell Hooks is coming to town, and she is going to be at Lewis and Clark College on Wednesday, February 1st at 7 o'clock, and also at Reed College on February the 2nd, also at 7 p.m., I've received information that both of those are sold out. However, you can actually be present at the simulcast in the student centers at each of those schools. Or, I'm sorry, in the Templeton Student Center at Lewis and Clark and in the Vollum Lecture Hall at Reed College. So,
that's that. So bell hooks, try not to miss that if you have the opportunity to go and check that out. Another event that's going on and that will be going on between now and I believe March 1st is an event in connection with the Everybody Reads Project through Multnomah County Library. There's an exhibit about the social conditions and cultural changes that women have dealt with during the decades of war and government upheaval in Afghanistan at the PSU Library. The exhibit is featuring several international groups that focus on peace and the status of women and children, such as the Revolutionary Women of Afghanistan Association. And so that's at the PSU Library. That's located at 1875 Southwest Park Avenue. And that will be from February 1st to through March 4th. And again, that is part of the Everybody Reads Project. And you can also check out the Revolutionary Women of Afghanistan Association online at rawa.org. And that's it for announcements tonight.
All right. Well, that's it for our program tonight. Thanks again to our guests this evening, Suzanne Marie Fanger, and to the Bread and Roses engineer, Molly. And I want to thank Brooke for all of her help in getting me up and running tonight. I really appreciate it. Tonight we heard music by Toshi Regan, actually the daughter of Bernice Regan, if you're familiar with Sweet Honey and the Rock. We also heard music from Lamb, Aretha Franklin, and Sonic Youth. And here's a song to take you into your Friday night. Y'all try to be fully human out there.